Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And let's start with upcoming announcements. I wanted to let you know that the Coastal Watershed Council is going to have their snapshot day on May 7th. But why am I telling you about it in advance? Well, because you got to get trained before you can do the snapshot day, and the trainings are coming up. And, they're still a month and a half away, but I thought you ought to get them on your calendar anyway. Coastal Watershed Council staff are very excited about the 12th annual Snapshot Day event. We are already gearing up and hope to see you out there. This year's event falls on Saturday, May 7th. In Santa Cruz, San Mateo, and Monterey counties, so mark your calendars. The community-based event provides an annual snapshot view of the health of rivers and streams that flow into Monterey Bay. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, including yours truly, Uncle Dennis, we systematically sample the stream waters throughout the central coast of California during this one-day, once-a-year event. Volunteers are trained by CWC and MBNMS staff to record field measurements and collect water samples for laboratory analysis. Volunteers who collect this data play a valuable role in our communities as stewards of our watersheds. The information provided is used by resource agencies, local governments, and community groups to protect and improve the health of our local watersheds. So come on out and get your feet wet. Join us on Saturday, May 7th for the snapshot day. If you need training, trainings will be held on the following dates. In Santa Cruz, Sunday, May 1st from 12 to 3 at Natural Bridges State Beach. In Monterey, Saturday, April 30th from 12 to 3 at the REI store in Marina. In San Mateo, it's taking place on Monday, May 2nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the San Gregorio General Store, and that's a fine place. Yeah, I've had a lot of fun there, and George, the owner, is a really great guy. And then for you folks down way, way south, far beyond the reach of my radio, but certainly not beyond the reach of the internet, is Cambria. And you folks will be having your training on Tuesday, May 3rd from 5 to 7 p.m. It doesn't have a location, but Cambria is a small enough place you'll probably find it. Now, I'll see if I can figure out where that's going to be. They probably don't have a spot for it yet. If you want to get involved or have some questions about Snapshot Day, call the Coastal Watershed Council at 831-464-9200. That's 464-9200. Or send an email to DJ Chirco. That's DJCHIRCO at coastalws.org. And that's always a fun day, even when it sprinkles a little bit. But usually by May, it's not raining all that much. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration, is having a habitat restoration. Yeah, that's what they do. This Saturday from March 12th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. over at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. I bet you they're going to be pulling some French broom. Hey, looky there. Spring is starting to show up here and there, and it's time to get out and start looking at the native wildflowers. We'll continue our broom bash efforts, removing invasive non-native French broom in the oak woodland areas of Quail Hollow. We may see poppies and ceanothus, red maids and blue-eyed grass, and maybe some showy pink flowering currants. Hope to see you out there. How to get there? Take Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz as you come down the hill into Felton. Turn right at the light. That's East Ziandi Road. Drive up 2 miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The entrance is a half a mile up the road on the right, and meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. If you want more information, contact their program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. Or email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net. Or visit their website at www.cruzcnps.org. great folks. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. For the first time in Buffalo Field Campaign history, with your insistent voice and persistent legal help from the Western Watershed Projects, our efforts have stopped the slaughter. No decisions were reached during Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk's meeting with Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer this week, but the Park Service has just announced that they intend to hold the buffalo in the trap until they release them in the spring. This is news for a sweet celebration. However, challenging times persist for our buffalo friends in the field. The bitter aspect is that the buffalo should never have been trapped in the first place. Never, nearly every day, these incarcerated buffalo have also been witnessing their relatives on the outside suffer repeated hazing. On Sunday, Yellowstone National Park and Montana Department of Livestock agents captured 45 more wild buffalo. Then again on Wednesday, another 62 wild buffalo who were visiting their imprisoned relatives were pushed into the trap. The Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap is now holding 630 wild buffalo captive. Yellowstone says that, although they had previously said there were no plans to capture more, these buffalo were not responding to repeated hazing, so they had to capture them. Buffalo follow their ancient instincts, not the desires of humans. They have no winter range inside Yellowstone National Park, and knowing no man-made boundaries, they, like other wildlife, simply must seek food and nourishment where they can find it. And that would be the lowland habitat that they're not allowed to go into. The habitat they need is available, but the government and livestock interests refuse to let them access it. There is some conversation brewing between Yellowstone and Montana about opening up potential habitat north of Yellowstone, but no details have yet been disclosed. Yellowstone's capture facility is well over capacity for holding this amount of buffalo, and now the park is saying they will begin transporting some of them to the empty quarantine pastures at the Corbin Springs quarantine facility. Holding the buffalo in confinement, especially around calving season, exacerbates the potential for the livestock disease brucellosis to circulate deeper throughout the wild buffalo population, and that has been admitted by Yellowstone's own bison biologist, Rick Wallen, when he was asked by the Buffalo Field Campaign. The buffalo that will be transported to the Corbin Springs facility will be near buffalo that have been raised in captivity since being stolen from the wild over 5 years ago as part of a government experiment to create a disease-free herd, more proof that all of the actions against wild buffalo have nothing to do with brucellosis. The park also reports that another buffalo, an older cow, has died in the trap. Buffalo Field Campaign has been requesting a media tour so that we can see the condition of the buffalo in the trap so far. The park has not made any plans to grant this request. Our legal efforts to set the buffalo free continue, and the Western Watersheds Project will be appealing our emergency injunction to the Ninth Circuit Court, with briefs scheduled to begin filing in May. Also, over the weekend, just outside of Gardner, Montana, six more bulls were killed by Nez Perce hunters. Four of these bulls had on a few days earlier been hazed off of their migratory path into the hunt zone by agents. Talk about setting them up for a kill. Another buffalo was killed by an out-of-town traveler on Highway 89 north of Gardner. Passersby reported that they saw emergency first responders taking photo opportunities with the dead buffalo, and the next morning, when patrols again saw his body, someone had illegally removed and taken his head. In wanting to leave you with some uplifting news, after years of our collective pressure, the Interagency Bison Management Plan agencies have finally admitted that bull buffalo are no threat to Montana's brucellosis-free status, so they are showing some tolerance for them outside the park in the Gardner Basin, when they're not hazing them into the hunt zone, that is. It's an extremely limited tolerance, but the result has been a small handful of bulls have been able to walk a little bit of the land for a few weeks without too much harassment. And a silver lining here is that local residents have been enjoying their presence in the Gardner area, where so many buffalo have been harassed and killed. More residents are contacting Buffalo Field Campaign with words of support, wanting to volunteer, and landowners want to show that support by posting our Bison Safe Zone signs on their lands. It is this kind of change that will grow into something really big and powerful for the buffalo. And if you'd like to help the Buffalo Field Campaign with their work, you can visit their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They have lists of things they need, and among those things is money. And once you figure out what you want to donate, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758, or give them a call at 406-646-0070, especially if you want to volunteer. They do have an application, which you can find on the website at www.buffalofieldcampaign. But any questions you want answered, that phone number again, 406-646-0070. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And here is the Spirit of Freedom, which is produced by the Earth Liberation Prisoners Support Network. Sadly, Earth Liberation Prisoners has some sad news for you this month. As many people will have already heard, Breonna Water has been re-indicted on a 9-count indictment. The same indictment has also been served against Joseph Dibby, Josephine Overacre, and Justin Sullins. The indictment alleges conspiracy to commit offense or defraud the United States, possessing an unregistered firearm, arson of a building used in interstate commerce or an activity affecting interstate commerce, using a destructive device during a crime of violence, and arson of a building belonging to an institution receiving federal financial assistance. The use of a destructive device charge alone carries a 30-year minimum sentence. The trial is currently set for June 27th of this year. For more information about that case, go to supportbrianna.org. That's support, B-R-I-A-N-A, .org. And as well as hearing Breonna's bad news, Earth Liberation Prisoners has also learned of the jailing of Scott McDemuth, see Eco Defense Prisoners at their website, and also the jailing of three Belarusians who are accused of a variety of activities, including anti-militarism and solidarity actions in support of two Russian environmentalists. The Belarusians are listed as other prisoners in their list. We don't know if the Belarusians can speak English, and our experience of writing to prisoners in Russia and Belarus is that if you write in any language other than the prisoner's own native language, the prisoner may be punished. So please only write in a language which the prison censors are likely to understand. And support the eco prisoners and no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. And do visit their website at www.ecoprisoners.org, where you can find descriptions and conditions of confinement for dozens and dozens of people who have been arrested in defense, in actions in defense of Mother Earth. It's kind of a bummer reading it, but maybe you want to take some time to write a letter to one or more of those people who are in prison. And a Utah green activist has been found guilty of fraud in an oil leasing sale. On this story by James Nelson, with writing by Steve Gorman, editing by Greg McCune of Thomson Reuters. An environmental activist was convicted a week ago of defrauding the federal government by submitting phony bids to derail an auction of oil and gas drilling rights on the vast tracts of public land in Utah. A federal court jury in Salt Lake City deliberated nearly 5 hours before finding Tim DeChristopher, 29 years old, guilty of fraud and violations of the U.S. Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act, capping an unusual 4-day trial. DeChristopher admitted posing as a private energy developer in December of 2008 for a government lease sale auction, where he ended up offering the winning bids for 22,500 acres of Interior Department mineral rights valued at $1.7 million. It was soon discovered that he had neither the money nor the intention to consummate the purchase, effectively scuttling about a fourth of the lease sales that were up for bid that day. DeChristopher said he was protesting what he and other environmentalists regard as a virtual government giveaway of valuable mineral rights under a program that degrades public lands and encourages greater reliance on fossil fuels for energy. He faces as much as 10 years in prison and a fine of up to $750,000 when he returns to court June 23rd for sentencing. Until then, DeChristopher remains free. He left the courthouse greeted by cheers and hugs from dozens of supporters who kept a vigil during the trial. And I'm going to read his entire statement that he made on the courthouse steps, but in just a minute. But in closing arguments to the jury, defense lawyer Ron Yengich said his client merely wanted people to think about the consequences that the auction was bringing to bear on other people. It was never his intention to harm anyone, and he harmed no one, except maybe some corporations who thought they were going to get a deal on some cheap oil and gas land. But Assistant U.S. Attorney John Huber told jurors that DeChristopher should be found guilty because he chose a path of illegality and criminal conduct. Well, sometimes you just have to do that to expose the corporation for what it is. And here is Tim DeChristopher's speech after the guilty verdict. What the world wanted to see was how you would react, and you have reacted with joy and resolve. You have shown that your power will not be intimidated by any power that they have, and that's the most important thing that's happened here this week. Because everything that happened inside the courthouse tried to convince me that I was alone and that I was weak. They tried to convince me that I was like a little finger out there on my own that could easily be broken. And all of you out here were the reminder for all of us that I wasn't just a finger all alone in there, but I was connected to hand with many fingers that could be united together as one fist, and that that fist could not be broken by the power that they have in there. That fist is not a symbol of violence. That fist is a symbol that we will not be misled into thinking that we are alone. We will not be lied to and told that we are weak. We will not be divided, and we will not back down. That fist is a symbol that we are connected and that we are powerful. It's a symbol that we hold true to our vision of a healthy and just world, and that we are building the self-empowering movement to make it happen. All of those authorities in there wanted me to think like a finger, but our children are calling us to think like a fist. And we know that now I'll have to go to prison. We know that now that is the reality. But that's just the job that I have to do. That's the role that I face. Many more before me have gone to jail for justice, and we are going to achieve our vision. Many after me will have to join me as well. No one ever told us that this battle would be easy. No one ever told us that we wouldn't have to make sacrifices. We knew that when we started this fight. Every wave on the ocean that has ever risen up and refused to lay back down has been dashed on the shore, but that is the very purpose of a wave, to rise up, because once it rises up above the horizon, it finally has the perspective to see that it's not just one wave, that it's part of a mighty ocean. And the sharpest rock on the wildest shore can never break that ocean apart. They can never wear that ocean down, because it's the ocean that shapes the shore. That's what we're starting to do here today. That's what we're starting to do here this week. With wave after wave after wave crashing against that shore, we will shape it to our vision. Thank you all for being a part of that. And that was the speech that Tim DeChristopher gave after being declared guilty of disrupting a minerals management sale last week. And also last week, the Merced River came under attack. Last week, an assault on the nation's environmental laws sunk to a historic low with the introduction of H.R. 869, a bill to roll back hard-won wild and scenic river protection for the Merced River. This bill, if passed, would be the first time in history that Congress had reversed course to allow a reservoir to flood a stretch of a national wild and scenic rivers system river. The bill was introduced for the Merced Irrigation District, whose desire is to inundate the Merced River between Briceburg and Bagby, is blocked by the National Wild and Scenic River Protection. H.R. 869 is sponsored by freshman Congressman Jeff Denham and co-sponsored by Congressman Devin Nunes, Jim Costin, Kevin McCarthy, and Dennis Cardoza. Congressman Denham, when he served in the California legislature, was one of the principal authors of the proposed California water bond, now scheduled for the ballot in 2012, which would set aside approximately $5 billion to be borrowed to be used for dam construction in California. Congressman Nunes is probably best known as a tireless champion of the multi-billion-dollar proposed Temperance Flat Dam on the San Joaquin River, a river that for half a century has already been sucked completely dry by existing dams and diversions there. However, last year there was a win that will allow the San Joaquin to live again. H.R. 869 must first pass the House Natural Resources Committee and then go before the full U.S. House of Representatives. It passes the House, it will be referred to the U.S. Senate. No matter where you live, let your senator and representative know that they must oppose this dangerous and unprecedented setting bill that would destroy the integrity of the natural wild and scenic river system. This is an odd place to see the first major challenge to the National Wild and Scenic River System, because the new Exchequer Dam, completed in 1967, that the Merced Irrigation District wants to raise, has never spilled. That means it's never gotten full. On May 7th, 1991, MID's board of directors voted 4-0 to support protecting the Merced River in the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System. Well, that was 20 years ago. Things are different today, I guess. The MID dams already bury about 24 miles of the Merced River under reservoirs. Using standard rules of thumb for storage to yield ratios, the district's hoped for expansion of the new Exchequer Dam might increase water supplies to the district by approximately 2%, a small gain that would come at a great price for the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System. The Merced River is probably one of the best-known rivers in the world. Its headwaters starting high in the mountains of Yosemite National Park, its gentle waters the centerpiece of Yosemite Valley, then its exuberant journey out of the park along Highway 140, where a lot of people do river rafting, the all-weather route to Yosemite, and the wildlands that await it in the U.S. Bureau of Land Management country before its waters are stilled under the giant Lake McClure Reservoir. If you want more information and to take action, go to the following website, www.friendsoftheriver.org. That's www.friendsoftheriver.org. And protect wild salmon. The Food and Drug Administration is close to approving genetically modified salmon for human consumption. We let you know about this a few weeks ago. This decision could be disastrous for wild salmon in the United States and around the world. We simply shouldn't let it happen. Please join Trout Unlimited today and tell the FDA to say no to genetically modified fish. As you may have heard, a group called Aqua Bounty Technologies has created a genetically modified salmon that grows twice as fast as conventional farm salmon. The company is seeking FDA approval to commercially market this frankenfish. So far, research and public debate has focused on the impacts of human consumption of the fish, but as anglers and conservationists, you know there's far more at stake. If genetically engineered salmon are produced on a commercial scale, fisheries experts say they would inevitably escape into the wild. If that occurs, it could cause catastrophic damage to the last remaining stocks of wild salmon. We do not question the FDA's ability to determine potential impacts to humans from eating genetically engineered fish, but they do not have the expertise to evaluate potential impacts on wild salmon. As fishermen and women, we have a unique perspective on this issue, and our voices must be heard. Please join with Trout Unlimited in asking the FDA to conduct a full environmental impact analysis and consult with salmon fisheries experts from Trout Unlimited, NOAA Fisheries, and the Fish and Wildlife Service before making a potentially disastrous decision. It's up to you and me to stand up and protect wild salmon and healthy fisheries. And for more information and to take action, go to the website www.tu.org. That's Trout Unlimited's website, www.tu.org. And a deal has been reached to manage fishing in the northeastern Pacific, and that's where we are. In this story by Alan Dowd, edited by Peter Galloway from Thomson Reuters, countries bordering the North Pacific Ocean have struck a deal that environmentalists said on Monday will help to protect 16.1 million square miles of ocean floor from a destructive technique called bottom trawl fishing. The agreement calls for the creation of an organization to manage sea bottom fisheries in the North Pacific and puts an immediate cap on expansion of bottom trawl fishing in international waters stretching from Hawaii to Alaska. The deal was reached last week in Vancouver by the United States, Japan, Canada, China, South Korea, Russia, and Taiwan after nearly 5 years of negotiations. Environmentalists have long complained about the damage done to sensitive ecosystems and marine life on the ocean floor by boats that use weighted nets and other fishing gear that drag along the seabed. Drag fishing can damage seamounts or undersea mountain ranges that attract fish and are home to cold water corals, deep sea sponges, and a wide range of other marine life, the United Nations warned in a 2006 report. What it does is freeze the footprint of where they are fishing now, said Ben Enticknap of Oceana, one of the environmental organizations that participated in the negotiations. The interim measure covering the northeastern Pacific will allow scientists time to study fish stocks and to develop a long-term management plan. The idea is that we can develop a more sustainable fishery, Ektenap said. An interim cap was already in place for the northwest Pacific, and there was concern about the remaining region being left unprotected, according to a copy of the agreement provided to Reuters. Scientists say fishing fleets have been increasingly turned to the high seas, including the North Pacific, as coastal fish stocks have been depleted and technology to locate the fish has improved. There are already agreements managing individual fish species, such as tuna, but fish living around seamounts have fallen through the cracks, said Daniel Pauly, a fisheries scientist at the University of British Columbia. Many of the species that are caught or killed inadvertently by drag fishing on seamounts also require a long time to reproduce and replenish their stocks, said Pauly, who likened the practice to coal mining that removes mountaintops. Pauly said that while the new protections are a good idea, it remains to be seen if the planned fisheries management organization will be given the power it needs to enforce the regulations. An environmental group said they remain concerned that about 5.1 million square miles of water remains unprotected between the ocean region covered by this agreement and the deal reached earlier for the South Pacific. And in our final story today, the decline of honeybees is now a global phenomenon, according to the United Nations, in this story by Michael McCarty, environment editor of the Independent News. The mysterious collapse of honeybee colonies is becoming a global phenomenon, scientists working for the United Nations have revealed. Declines in managed bee colonies, seen increasingly in Europe and the United States in the past decade, are also now being observed in China and Japan, and there are the first signs of African collapses from Egypt, according to the report from the United Nations Environment Program. The authors, who include some of the world's leading honeybee experts, issued a stark warning about the disappearance of bees, which are increasingly important as crop pollinators around the globe. Without profound changes to the way human beings manage the planet, they say, declines in pollinators needed to feed a growing global population are likely to continue. The scientists warn that a number of factors may be coming together to hit bee colonies around the world, ranging from declines in flowering plants and the use of damaging insecticides to the worldwide spread of pests and air pollution. They call for farmers and landowners to be offered incentives to restore pollinator-friendly habitats, including key flowering plants near crop-producing fields, and stress that more care needs to be taken in the choice, timing, and application of insecticides and other chemicals. While managed hives can be moved out of harm's way, wild populations of pollinators are completely vulnerable, says the report. The way humanity manages or mismanages its nature-based assets, including pollinators, will in part define our collective future for the 21st century, said Akeem Steiner, UN Undersecretary General and UNEP Executive Director. The fact that of the 100 crop species that provide 90% of the world's food, over 70 are pollinated by bees. Human beings have fabricated the illusion that in the 21st century they have the technological prowess to be independent of nature. Bees underline the reality that we are more, not less, dependent on nature's services in a world of close to 7 billion people. Declines in bee colonies date back to the mid-1960s in Europe, but have accelerated since 1998, while in North America, losses of colonies since 2004 have left the continent with fewer managed pollinators than at any time in the past 50 years, says the report. Now, Chinese beekeepers have recently faced several inexplicable and complex symptoms of colony losses on both species, the report says. And it has been reported elsewhere that some Chinese farmers have had to resort to pollinating fruit trees by hand because of the lack of insects. Furthermore, a quarter of the beekeepers in Japan have recently been confronted with a sudden losses of their bee colonies, while in Africa, beekeepers along the Egyptian Nile have been reporting signs of colony collapse disorder, although to date there are no other confirmed reports from the rest of the continent. The report lists a number of factors which may be coming together to cause the decline, and they include habitat degradation, including the loss of flowering plant species that provide food for the bees, some insecticides, including the so-called systemic insecticides that can migrate to the entire plant as it grows and be taken in by bees in the nectar and plant pollen, parasites and pests, such as the well-known varroa mite, air pollution, which may be interfering with the ability of bees to find flowering plants and thus food, scents that could travel more than 800 meters in the 1800s now reach less than 200 meters from a plant. The transformation of the countryside and rural areas in the past half century or so has triggered a decline in wild living bees and other pollinators, said one of the lead authors, Dr. Paul Newman of the Swiss Bee Research Center. Society is increasingly investing in industrial-scale hives and managed colonies to make up the shortfall, and going so far as to truck bees around to farms and fields in order, order to maintain our food supplies, he said. A variety of other factors are making these man-made colonies vulnerable to decline and collapse. We need to get smarter about how we manage these hives, but perhaps more importantly, we need to better manage the landscape beyond in order to recover wild bee populations. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. I want to thank you for listening. The Earth First Update returns next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock. If you'd like to hear a podcast or download a copy of a previous Earth First Update, go to the following website, www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get to that site, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you again for listening, and tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First Update.